Well, hello there, ladies and gentlemen, and thanks for joining us here in the Fred Bertelsen Memorial Old Time Radio Room of RadioOutOfThePast.org for another round of Mike's Saturday Night OTR Surprise. Today's date is Saturday, April 22nd, 2017, and this is your MSS host, Luis Jr., assisting with bringing to you another exciting and ultra-exhilarating broadcast of this special OTR program. I would just like to take the time and introduce the newest presenter on the MSS crew. You all might have heard this gentleman from time to time. And to give you a little hint, he's a snowman and he just so happens to be a little silly. And he is on the radio a lot, so if you haven't guessed it, it is Bobby Braxma. Yep, Bobby B is part of the crew now, and he will be doing his thing and producing his own particular brand of OTR surprises for your listening enjoyment. Without any further delays, I would just ask if you could please sit back, grab your favorite drinks and snacks, and enjoy the program. Because right now, Bobby B, the microphone is yours.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Michael's Saturday Night Surprise, and I'm your host tonight, Bob Braxma. Tonight, I'll be taking you on a very surprising and informative journey about audio trademarks.
This is 99% Invisible. I'm Roman Mars. Sound design is one of the more overlooked aspects of design, but it's so critical to our enjoyment of the world. Few sounds please me more than the satisfying woof that my car doors make when I get inside my VW. My current least favorite sounds are from credit card chip readers that blare an obnoxious warning buzz that clearly signals to normal humans that something has gone wrong, even though it actually means everything went right and it's time to remove your card. My love of sound and story is why I was excited to find the new podcast, 20,000 Hertz, which tells the stories behind the most recognizable and interesting sounds. And I'm pleased to present one of their episodes today. Here, host Dallas Taylor tells the story behind the most famous sound in broadcasting.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.
For being only three tiny notes, the NBC chimes have had a colossal impact on media and culture for nearly 90 years. It was back in the late 1920s when NBC started using this for the first time to identify itself on the radio.
WEAF New York.
They became so iconic and so popular that they were the very first sound to ever be awarded an audio trademark. And that's hard to get. Take, for example, the Harley-Davidson engine sound. After 6 years of litigation and challenges from other companies, they withdrew their application. Courts also denied Motorola's request to trademark its chirp, saying that, among other things, they didn't do a good enough job promoting it as an actual sound mark. Budweiser even tried to trademark the sound of an opening beer can. I think I'm going to go with the courts on this one. So, there are only about 100 sounds that have actually officially become U.S. trademarks, and most of them are incredibly iconic.
Oh!
Ho, ho, ho.
You've got mail.
The concept of a trademark is that it's something that's generally accepted, that can't be confused with something else, that you can make the case represents your product.
That's Rick Greenhut. He used to work for NBC and was actually the last person to ever officially play the chimes on the NBC radio network.
An audio trademark that doesn't have any lyrics in it, it's very hard to say, well, this represents my product. And the reason NBC could actually trademark that is they've been doing it for 40 years before anybody thought to trademark it.
Today, whenever you think about branding, you think about the visual mark, the visual logo. But back in the 1920s, the most powerful form of mass communication was the radio. The only way you could brand yourself would be through sound.
Anybody who heard that in the 50s or 60s would instantly know it was NBC.
The chimes were everywhere. They were so popular that they even appeared in some pop songs. This is Announcer's Blues, recorded in 1936 by Paul Whiteman and his orchestra. The artist behind this next track, NBC I Love You, remains a broadcasting mystery.
On the NBC each night you hear three tones ring out. They have a special meaning, so here's what it's all about.
To understand where the chimes came from, we have to go back nearly a century.
Stations were using chimes, gongs, all kinds of different musical devices to create a sound signature for themselves.
This is John Snyder, a radio historian. Chimes in particular would have been an easy choice due to how common they were. Dinner chimes were often used to summon guests to the table, and it was also used to indicate the start and stop of intermission.
NBC created a seven-note sequence, and the idea was that at the end of each program, the announcer who's at the microphone and is saying, "This is the National Broadcasting Company," would strike a seven-note chime sequence on a set of hand chimes that he held next to the microphone.
As you could imagine, since this was being played live by the announcer, it was really hard to keep consistent. So they shortened it to three notes.
Originally, the three notes were CAF, which had the same sound that we know today, just in a different key. Eventually, they used the notes GEC, which some people think stood for the General Electric Company.
That would have been the coolest branding story, having the GEC chime stand for the General Electric Company. But the truth is, General Electric didn't have much to do with NBC until later.
Eventually, because it still wasn't being done uniformly on the hand chimes, they went to an electronic device.
I remember getting a tour of the technical facility.
That's Rick Greenhead again.
There was this strange thing back in the racks, and I said, "What's that?" And they said, "It's a chimes machine."
NBC hired an electronic organ pioneer, Captain Richard Ranger, to build more of an automated system for playing the chimes. Not only did the chimes serve a branding purpose, but it also solved a really big technical challenge.
When they would change studios, they would be literally plugging and unplugging these patch cords, and it would make kind of clicks and pops on the air. Since we end each show with the chimes, each studio would have a take control button and a chimes button. When you pushed the chimes button, it would take that studio off the air under the sound of the chimes, so you didn't hear the click.
Aside from its iconic cultural status, the NBC chimes also played a really important role in history. Outside of radio, the only other form of mass communication was through newspaper.
There was no medium that passed news or information or entertainment to the public in real time.
Again, John Snyder.
And all of the people who were pioneers, they had to invent techniques that we take for granted today. It must have been a fascinating time to participate in the birth of modern electronic media.
One of radio's most important moments came during World War II. For the first time in history, news from the front lines of war could become available to the mass public in near real time.
Radio had discovered its importance as a news medium and not just an entertainment medium.
During the war, NBC added a fourth chime to covertly notify announcers that important breaking news was imminent.
If the normal chime was GEC, at the end of a program, they would play the chime GECC.
The National Broadcasting Company will continue its network service throughout the remainder of the night in view of the important but so far unconfirmed reports from overseas. This is the National Broadcasting Company.
Beep.
that fourth note, which probably most of the radio audience never even noticed, was a cue to the radio stations, pay attention, listen on the line between the program, and be prepared for something momentous to come along.
When it rings, all of us at NBC spring into action, wherever we may be. The fourth chime means to us, call the office. Get down here. Big things are happening.
During the invasion of D-Day, the NBC fourth chime was played alongside the Morse code sound for the letter V, indicating that the invasion had just begun.
That extra chime, the fourth chime, means news of the greatest world importance. The fourth chime rang on D-Day. The fourth chime will ring again on V-Day, the day of victory.
Thankfully, the fourth chime was only played a handful of times in the history of the network. NBC was huge. All the other networks were still up and coming, so NBC commanded all the top talent.
Ladies and gentlemen, from Camp Hahn, California, we bring you a man who pedaled here all the way from Hollywood on the rear end of a tandem bicycle, Jack Benny.
People who were getting the ratings and the people who were the next day's water cooler conversation, that would be the radio show from NBC the night before. So NBC to me always had seemed like a Cadillac brand. It was a brand whose name you remembered, whose logo you could picture, and when you heard the sound, you pictured the logo. When you saw the logo, you heard the sound in your mind.
The NBC chimes, at least on the radio, came to a close in the late 1980s when Rick Greenhut played them for the last time on the 9 o'clock news.
We typically would chime out of every network feed we did. And at about 8:45, the newscaster's already in the booth, the producer sitting next to me. I've got the commercials in the machines for each of the time zones. And the general manager comes up and he said, I wanted you to be the first to know that the radio network has been sold.
General Electric acquired NBC Radio through the purchase of RCA. This meant that NBC Radio no longer operated as its own entity.
The NBC chimes were not part of the sale because they're the NBC chimes and the TV network is keeping those. 9 o'clock hour comes, we do the network newscast, and at 9:05:30, the newscaster says, Gary Nunn, NBC News, New York, and I play the chimes. I then pulled that tape cartridge out of the machine where I'd played it. Well, no sooner had I done that, but the general manager shows up and he just looked at me and he said, make sure no one else can do that. I did that by taking that tape cartridge home, and it's sitting on my shelf.
The NBC radio network came to a close, but obviously the chimes still live on through promos and special programming and news. But this sound is bigger than Comcast or NBC or General Electric. It's something that's deeply embedded and weaved through our history, through the good,
an amazing little boy who just
through the bad,
1 month after the massacre at
through the most important moments of our collective lives together.
This is an NBC News special report.
This sound has been with us for almost 90 years. It started as a sound that just fixed a small problem, but has become something that's completely ingrained in our culture.
Hertz is a production of DeFacto Sound. You can find it at 20k.org or wherever you get podcasts. This episode was produced by Carolyn McCulley, Sam Sneebly, Colin Navarney, Mylon Fitzwater Barrows, and Dallas Taylor. Sound design and mix by Colin Navarney. Special thanks to Rick Greenhut.
I sure hope you enjoyed that. Coming up next, more things about trademarks and sounds from our past and from our present.
Soaking in it. Your teeth were whiter than new. You Influence with Terry O'Reilly.
One day during practice, Boston Bruins goaltender Jerry Cheevers got hit in the mask with a puck. It was a light tap that wouldn't have broken an egg. But Cheevers never liked to practice, so he saw an opportunity. He threw his hands up to his face, faked a serious injury, and immediately rushed to the dressing room. A little while later, Bruins coach Harry Sinden walked in to check on his number one goalie. And he found Cheevers enjoying a Coke and a freshly lit cigar. Sinden wasn't happy, as you can imagine, and ordered Cheevers back to practice. But before Cheevers went back out, he drew black stitches on the white mask where the puck had hit him. When Cheevers stepped onto the ice, he pointed to the stitches and said, "See how bad it is?" The team got a good laugh out of it. But from that day forward, Cheevers drew stitches on the mask every time he got hit. It became a symbol for the number of times he would have been cut. He estimates that his mask saved him from over 150 real stitches. Cheevers became the first goaltender to decorate a goalie mask. Unlike other goalie masks that followed, that were highly ornate but static, Cheevers' mask was constantly evolving. Every time he got hit, a new stitch mark appeared. He wore that one Scarface mask for his entire career, and the number of scars it accumulated was astounding. There wasn't a square inch that wasn't covered in stitches. Today, that distinctive mask hangs in a place of honor, in the bedroom of Jerry Cheevers' grandson. It is considered the most famous goalie mask of all time, and it was, without a doubt, Jerry Cheevers' trademark. In the world of marketing, trademarks are pretty serious business. Companies strive to add unique elements to their branding and products in order to stand out from their competitors. But like Cheevers' mask, trademarks take a lot of nasty hits from other companies. There's flat-out plagiarism, infringements, and lots of sneaky little end runs. So companies have to protect their trademarks vigorously in courts of law. But it may surprise you to learn what is, in fact, trademarked. And some of those trademarks might actually leave you in stitches.
You're under the influence.
Creating a unique brand is the holy grail in marketing. As you've heard me say many times before, differentiating a brand from all competitors in a category is the key to attracting customers and carving out a dominant market share. Part of creating a uniquely defined brand is to produce design elements or intellectual property that are proprietary to the brand, then protecting those elements legally. That's where trademarks come in. According to the law, if an element of a brand takes on a secondary meaning, it can theoretically be trademarked. In other words, if a logo or a sound or a set of words becomes linked to a brand, and if the sight or mention of this element makes people instantly think of a single brand, it can be protected legally. Think Beatles. According to the dictionary, it means
insects of an order distinguished by forewings, typically modified into hardwing cases that cover and protect the hindwings and abdomen.
But over the years, the word has taken on a secondary meaning.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles!
Hence, the Beatles is a well-protected trademark. Trademarks can take many forms. Sometimes it can be a shape or a design. Electronic music producer Joel Zimmerman is a very successful recording artist. He's better known to fans as Deadmau5. He wears a big mouse head when he performs. It has big ears, vacant white eyes, and a creepy grin. Beyond being a Grammy-nominated musician, Deadmau5 has an extensive line of merchandise based on his mouse head symbol. The list includes hats, t-shirts, mobile apps, recording equipment, BMX bikes, food items, and much, much more. Then, one day, Deadmau5 was sued for trademark infringement. Can you guess who sued him? Yep, Disney. Disney is notoriously protective of its trademarks, especially that of Mickey Mouse, the icon that launched the company back in the 1920s. To give you an idea of how particular Disney is, it successfully forced a bar in New York called Mickey's Mousetrap to change its name, even though the two owners were both named Mickey. The owners said they had to cave in because they didn't have the money to fight a corporation the size of Disney. So, it should come as no surprise that Disney sued Deadmau5. But actually, it did surprise Deadmau5. The reason it surprised him was that he'd been using the mouse head for almost 10 years. On top of that, he had had several business dealings with Disney over that time. For example, Disney had asked him to consider remixing Fantasia for the film's 75th anniversary. And Deadmau5 was in talks with Disney to remix the Star Wars theme. But out of the blue, in September of 2014, Disney filed a 171-page document stating that the Deadmau5 design was nearly identical in appearance, connotation, and overall commercial impression to Disney's Mickey Mouse, and that it would cause confusion among consumers. Deadmau5 responded by tweeting, "Lawyer up, Mickey." Then Deadmau5 did a cursory search on Google and discovered something interesting. Disney was using a song of his called Ghosts and Stuff in a video without his permission. Plus, the video actually ended with his mouse head logo, the same logo that Disney said would confuse the public. So Deadmau5 fired off a cease and desist letter to Disney, saying the company had violated his music copyright and his trademark. In a subsequent tweet, Deadmau5 said, quote, "Let's test a theory. It takes Disney 10 years to oppose a trademark. Let's see how long it takes them to take down a video." Disney took the video down immediately. 9 months later, the lawsuits were settled amicably. While the details of the suit weren't released, Deadmau5 still performs in his mouse head, and the Disney video using Ghosts and Stuff is still online. Looks like they split the trademark cheese right down the middle. The Deadmau5 story shows how seriously companies take their design trademarks. But sounds can also be trademarked. The litmus test for a sound trademark is that the sound has to be so inherently different or distinct that it attaches to the subliminal mind of the listener, and, when awakened or heard, is instantly associated with a single product or event. That definition was established when the very first sound was trademarked.
To see all the photos and videos from this episode, go to cbc.ca/underTheInfluence.
The very first sound to be trademarked originally aired in 1929.
NBC Television.
It was the NBC chime. That sound was finally registered by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office in 1950. But a noise is one of the most difficult elements to protect legally. Harley Davidson tried to trademark the potato, potato, potato chug of its idling twin motorcycle engine. But both Honda and Yamaha opposed Harley's trademark application, arguing that the sound is a characteristic of all V-twin motorcycle engines and that it predated Harley. Harley Davidson fought hard for 6 years, but in the end gave up the battle. A sound is hard to trademark. In the U.S., millions of trademarks have been granted, but in the entire trademark library, there are less than 200 for sounds. In Canada, you could only begin trademarking sounds as of 2012. Only 25 sound marks have been registered since then. But you may be surprised to hear which sounds are, in fact, trademarked. Like this one. The familiar sound from Law and Order is trademark number 7664194. Composer Mike Post created it using the sound of a jail door slamming combined with musical notes. The U.S. Patent and Trademark Office describes this sound as consisting of two musical notes, a strike, and a rapid rearticulation of a perfect fifth pitch interval, which in the key of C sounds the notes C and G struck concurrently. Mike Post simply calls it Ching Ching because he makes so much money off it. CBS has a trademark on this sound. The famous 60-minute stopwatch. Trademark number 7628075 sounds like this. By the way, Homer's famous dough is never spelled out in scripts. From the first episode on, it is simply referred to as annoyed grunt. Let's see if you can guess trademark sound number 7532-6989 as it is described on the U.S. Patent and Trademark website. It says it is a series of 10 sounds alternating between the chest and falsetto registers of the voice as follows. The first sound is a semi-long sound in the chest register. Sound number 2 is a short sound up an interval of 1 octave plus a fifth from the preceding sound. Sound 3 is a short sound down a major third from the preceding sound. Number 4 is a short sound up a major third from the preceding sound. The fifth is a long sound down 1 octave plus a major third from the preceding sound. The sixth is a short sound up 1 octave from the preceding sound. Number 7 is a short sound up a major third from the preceding sound. Number 8 is a short sound down a major third from the preceding sound. Sound number 9 is a short sound up a major third from the preceding sound. And number 10 is a long sound down an octave plus a fifth from the preceding sound. There. Any ideas what that is? Well, when you put all that together, the trademark sounds like this. The Tarzan yell, first made famous by actor Johnny Weissmuller in the movie Tarzan the Ape Man in 1932. Trademark number 7741925 is described as the sound of rhythmic mechanical human breathing created by breathing through a scuba tank regulator. Can you guess what that is? Yep, that would be Mr. Darth Vader's breathing sound. Try this one. Trademark number 7616389 is described as, quote, the sound of a childlike human giggle. Any ideas? You know it well. It sounds like this. The Pillsbury Doughboy giggle. Used since 1965 in over 600 commercials. Trademark number 7582149 is filed as a deep male human-like voice saying three sounds in even intervals with each dropping in pitch. It's a sound you've heard ever since you were a kid. Give up?
Ho, ho, ho.
Green Giant.
That is one of the most identifiable branding sounds in all of marketing. And I noticed on the U.S. trademark site that it is no longer protected. It says the registrant, General Mills, didn't file the appropriate paperwork as of this writing. Interesting. Okay, one more. Trademark number 7630777 simply says it is the sound of a duck quacking a word. Bet you can guess that one.
Aflac.
Brought to you by the American Family Life Assurance Company, or Aflac for short. While sounds can sometimes be trademarked, so too can sentences. Michael Buffer is famous for being the ring announcer at big primetime boxing events. He's a good-looking guy, looks great in a tuxedo, and has a big voice. But in his early days of ring announcing, he realized he needed a catchphrase. So he tried, "Man your battle station." No response from the crowd. So next he tried, "Fasten your seatbelt." Crickets. Then one day Michael Buffer heard Muhammad Ali say, "Rumble, young man, rumble." So he took that notion, shortened it, and began saying,
"We're here tonight to witness 12 rounds of boxing in the heavyweight division. Let's get ready to rumble, introducing first in the red corner."
And so on. Then one day a friend of his said, "You know when you say, 'Let's get ready to rumble'?" Buffer said, "Yes." His friend said, "Shut up after that." And Buffer said, what do you mean?" And his friend said, "The crowd is dying to hear you say it. They want to go crazy." So from that point on, Buffer would say the line, then pause. And sure enough, the crowd went crazy.
Let's get ready to rumble!
The line became so famous that it started popping up everywhere, in editorial headlines, on television programs, and in commercials. So Buffer went to his lawyer to ask if his line could be trademarked. The answer was yes. It was intellectual property that was clearly associated with Buffer, which meant he could own and protect it. So he trademarked, "Let's get ready to rumble," and get a load of this. Since then, Michael Buffer has made over $400 million off that catchphrase. By trademarking that sentence, he doesn't even have to say it to make money from it. He now makes more from the trademark than from personal appearances. He has licensed it to video games, movies, TV shows, commercials, and merchandise. And Buffer has won over 100 court cases protecting the trademark. He is a rich man today, all from trademarking one line, followed by one very important pause.
Let's get ready to rumble!
Along with sentences, single words can be trademarked too. Facebook, for example, has trademarked the words "face" when it comes to websites. It's true. And did you know this? The word "superhero" is trademarked. And here's the strange thing about that. The trademark is co-owned by Marvel and DC Comics. Both companies realized that if they battled it out, there was a chance that neither would get it and the word would be completely unprotected. So they decided to work together. It is so rare for two big competitors to jointly own a trademark. As a matter of fact, I can't think of another example of that. It was also an odd decision for the trademark office to make. The very definition of a trademark is a single source of origin. Therefore, if the public links the word superhero to both Marvel and DC Comics, then by definition it is a generic word, not a single trademark. But somehow, Marvel and DC Comics persuaded the trademark office that it could be co-owned, and they were granted joint ownership in 1980. Never underestimate the power of superheroes. One day, author Patrick Wensink released his new book titled Broken Piano for President. Shortly after, he received the nicest cease and desist letter. It was from whiskey maker Jack Daniels. The cover of his book was designed to look like the black Jack Daniels label. The letter Wensink got from Jack Daniels explained that his book cover infringed on the company's famous trademark. The Tennessee whiskey maker went on to say that Wensink could change the cover on the next reprint of the book. In other words, he didn't have to do it right away. But if Wensink did want to change the cover before then, Jack Daniels would happily help him pay for the new cover. Wensick didn't take the money, but he sure was surprised by how nice the cease and desist letter was. When Jack Daniels was asked by the press why it was so nice to the author, the company said it believed a brand shouldn't talk in one voice to its customers, then come out swinging a sledgehammer when someone does something it doesn't like. While it does have to be diligent about protecting its trademarks, Jack Daniels also believes in being civil about it. It handles the hundreds of yearly trademark infringements internally first and only calls in their lawyers as a last resort, which explains the Southern hospitality. By the way, author Patrick Wensink got another gift from the Jack Daniels situation. When he posted the nice cease and desist letter on his website, the story went viral. As a result, his book got so much publicity that it shot up to number 6 on the bestseller charts, proving not all trademark skirmishes have to be nasty. Cheers to that. While at the Cannes Advertising Festival in 2015, I attended a talk with shock rocker Marilyn Manson. He was a very articulate and thoughtful speaker. His real name is Brian Warner, and he told us the story behind his famous stage name. He chose it by mashing together Marilyn Monroe with Charles Manson. He was making a statement that you could become famous in this day and age by being a celebrity or a murderer. Then one day, a mass murder was blamed on his celebrity. The Columbine High School Massacre.
So, if you are just joining us, two young men apparently dressed in long black trench coats opened fire about an hour and a half ago at a high school just outside of Denver in Littleton, Colorado.
In Cannes, Marilyn Manson told us the most remarkable story. As you may remember, 12 students and one teacher were murdered at the Columbine High School shooting in 1999. Almost 24 more were injured. The media reported that the two shooters were wearing Marilyn Manson-style makeup. They weren't. The media reported the shooters were wearing Marilyn Manson T-shirts. They weren't. The media also reported that the killers were Marilyn Manson music fans. They were not. But once the media cycle got hold of those false stories, they went around the world. Because Marilyn Manson was accused of inspiring the shootings, stadiums and casinos refused to hire him. He got death threats. Essentially, the Columbine murders shut down his career. So Marilyn Manson did the most interesting thing. He trademarked his name. That legal move allowed him to put a cease and desist order out to the press. That prevented the press from continuing to link Marilyn Manson to the killings. And once the press was forced to stop linking Marilyn Manson to the killings, he was able to work again. The trademark not only protected his name, it revived his career. The most successful companies stand out from the crowd. They have unique designs, wording, and sometimes even sounds that are linked specifically to their brands. And protecting those unique elements is critical in a competitive marketplace. The interesting thing about protecting a trademark is that a company is forced to be diligent about it. Not long ago, Facebook, a $300 billion company, sued a small six-person business that had the word face in their URL. While it seems like bullying, a company must challenge all trademark infringements. Here's why. If other companies start using your trademark, even tiny companies, a court of law might not let you keep your trademark at renewal time. If it's not linked exclusively to you, you can't protect it. That's why Facebook goes after a tiny six-person company. Of course, tone is everything. A company can unleash its legal hounds, or it can take a leaf from Jack Daniels and try to work it out amicably. In the world of marketing, a trademark is incredibly valuable. It can identify a product, differentiate a company, and it can even save a career. as Marilyn Manson discovered. That's why trademarks are jealously protected and why companies are so ready to rumble when you're under the influence. I'm Terry O'Reilly.
I'd like to thank you for joining me tonight here at MSS. Learned a few things about trademarks that I didn't know, and I really enjoyed hearing the stories that went along with some of the more popular things that I remembered from my past. And one more thing, Michael, if you don't do it now, you may never have the chance, but it might be a good idea to trademark MSS. Have a good evening, folks, and thanks for listening. Bye for now.
Okay, Bob, thanks a lot. I will take it from here to do what I do best, and that is wrap it up and shut it down for this week's broadcast of Michael's Saturday Night Surprise. But don't worry, we will be back again. You know where to find us, you know how, and you know where. We won't be broadcasting Mike's Saturday Night Surprise until 2 weeks from now, because on the 29th, the much-anticipated, much-awaited spring OTR marathon will be upon us. So, if you want to get over-injected and overdose on old-time radio, I suggest that you go to the Fred Bertelsen old-time radio room of Radio Out of the Past next week so that you can get all that you can handle. If you have any questions, comments, or complaints about tonight's programming, please address it to Michael Milley at earthlink.net. That's M-I-K-E-A-M-E-L-I @earthlink.net. We will soon be releasing the key and returning the room to you, the listening audience. Please do with it as you wish, or as long as you wish. But just remember, be nice to one another. On behalf of myself and the entirety of the MSS crew, have a great night, a great weekend, and goodbye.